that's just part of, you know, what makes Alaska, Alaska. It's a very fire-prone ecosystem, and it's just very resistant to fire suppression, even a year later.
A fast-moving fire northeast of McGrath is a flare-up from last year. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, Memorial Day, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a film about a small icebreaker with a big history.
They were working with a group to help save this old military ship from a scrapyard and thought I would be a good person to work on it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
A wildfire about 50 miles northeast of McGrath has grown quickly since it was first detected yesterday. Tim Mowry with the Alaska Division of Forestry says the fire is now more than 1,600 acres. Mowry says wind has been pushing the fire. It's about 20 miles from the small community of Medfra.
Actually burning sort of parallel to the North Fork of the Kuskokwim River, and we're just trying to keep it on that side of the Kuskokwim River right now. Hopefully the wind will cooperate. It's still pretty windy out there.
Mowry says he does not think Medfra or McGrath are in danger, as the fire is at a considerable distance and burning in a remote area. He says the fire is considered a holdover from the Soda Creek fire that burned more than 16,000 acres last year.
That's the thing about Alaska, is we have a lot of bog, we have a lot of peat, and these fires will get themselves buried down in, you know, down into that stuff, and they're pretty resistant to anything at that point, you know, snow, rain. But that's just part of, you know, what makes Alaska, Alaska. It's a very fire-prone ecosystem, and it's very resistant to fire suppression, even a year later.
Mowry says there was a holdover flare-up on the Kenai Peninsula recently from last year's Card Street fire, and even a flare from the two-year-old Funny River fire. Burn bans are in place in many parts of south-central Alaska. Mowry says as Alaskans conclude their Memorial Day camping trips, it's important to thoroughly put out campfires before they head home. A mountaineer from the Czech Republic is dead after an estimated 1,500-foot fall on Denali Mountain. The National Park Service reports 45-year-old Pavel Mikut was skiing Messner Collier when he fell Saturday. Nearby climbers found his body within 10 minutes. A Park Service statement says hard-packed snow conditions had developed in the area because of days of extreme wind. The body will be flown to the Alaska State Medical Examiner once the weather is safe. Congress is considering funding a new icebreaker to serve in the Arctic. It would be a heavy polar-class Coast Guard cutter to get through thick ice. But size isn't everything when it comes to Coast Guard ships. A Juno man has made a film about the Storis, a dainty icebreaker by polar standards that rescued mariners and enforced the law along Alaska's coast for almost 60 years. APRN's Liz Ruskin caught up with the filmmaker before a screening at the Navy Memorial in Washington, D.C.
There you go. Thank you. And done. And I hope you enjoy it.
It took Damon Stubner 8 years to make this documentary. He and his wife, Rebecca Smith, worked on it in between their state jobs as their time and money allowed. Now they recoup a teeny bit with the sale of $20 DVDs, one at a time.
It was a labor of love.
Sometimes love shows up when you least expect it. This one came on a snowy night in Juneau when Stubner and Smith were in the throes of moving.
We were moving into our house and someone walked by and said that they were working with a group to help save this old military ship from a scrapyard and thought I would be a good person to work on it. And my reaction at the time was, sorry, I'm moving into a house. I don't have the time. But he kept insisting, and finally I relented.
Stubner is a former TV news videographer who now works for the state division that includes archives. He and Smith traveled to the National Archives and elsewhere in the lower 48 to find documents, videos, and photographs, and to conduct interviews. The result is a 1 hour and 40-minute documentary. It traces Storrs's journey from its work in World War II to its long history in Alaska, dating to 1948 when it came to Juneau. Stubner says the story of the ship tells Alaska's story.
Storrs was there for the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It was there for the Trans-Alaska pipeline construction. It was there for the 1964 earthquake. It was there during the Cold War of mapping of the Arctic during the Dew Line operations. It was the very first ship to have law enforcement seizures in the Bering Sea.
Storrs was the first, or the last, or the oldest, in a lot of categories. It was the first American ship, for instance, to travel the Northwest Passage from the Bering Sea through the Arctic to the Eastern Seaboard. It's a gripping part of the movie as Storrs and its two companion ships battled thickening ice.
We were just stuck and lifted up by the ice, and wherever the ice flow went, we went.
Tuesday, 30th July, 1957. Tire fenders were rigged out and we waited. Engines were to no avail. Ice blocked screws and rudders, and the relentless elements just took over control. Listing was extreme. Spar heeled.
As Stubner's film tells it, the Storrs wasn't so much stuck in ice as getting pushed out of it as the sea froze under the hull. The film includes footage of crew members walking on the jumbled ice, trying everything, even dynamite, to release the cutters. Perhaps most suspenseful is the story of Storrs' attempt to rescue the fishermen of the Alaskan Monarch in the Bering Sea in 1990. It's a saga told with interviews and video from multiple cameras that were on scene.
They had to use the basket as a kind of a dredge to get the basket down into the ice and get those people out of the ice and up into the helicopter.
In 1991, Storrs became the oldest Coast Guard ship, the so-called Queen of the Fleet. She held the crown for 16 years. The documentary shows her decommissioning and her exile, stripped of all ornament and instrument, anchored in purgatory in a California bay. When Stubner began his film, a group was working to save the Storrs as a museum. Juneau attorney Joe Geldhoff was part of the museum group.
The Storrs was a vessel worth preserving. It just didn't happen.
In 2013, the U.S. government sold Storrs for $70,000 and she was taken away for scrap. The Alaska Congressional delegation tried to pass a bill to spare her for a museum. Geldhoff says it's not that anyone really opposed the idea. But he says Storrs was lost in the congressional scuffle.
Do I feel bad that we didn't save the ship? Sure, but I'm really pleased to see we brought together a lot of people and we're commemorating the people who sailed this ship.
The documentary, Geldhoff says, now serves as the ship's memorial. As for Stubner, he's already working on his next Coast Guard documentary. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state is seeking contractors to look into the feasibility of privatizing four of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services' juvenile detention facilities. The Peninsula Clarion reports the department is considering privatizing in an effort to cut costs as the legislature looks to trim the state budget. The feasibility study is required by a DHSS reform bill passed by the legislature and currently waiting for Governor Bill Walker's signature. DHSS Division of Juvenile Justice Director Rob Wood says the study will focus on determining whether switching to private juvenile centers would both cut costs and maintain quality of care. The study will focus on facilities in Kenai, Palmer, Nome, and Ketchikan. Wood says those are short-term detention centers, unlike the department's other four facilities. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, excitement over an unusual bird sighting.
And I was just really kind of flipping out inside. I didn't realize that it would be the first Alaska record, but I knew it was going to be really rare.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
On a busy summer day, thousands of people, mostly cruise ship passengers, visit Juneau's Mendenhall Glacier. The U.S. Forest Service wants those tourists to take in the dramatic views, but also consider why the glacier is shrinking. Visitor Center Director John Neary is making it his personal mission. As KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins found out, that means trying to make the message stick long after the tourists are gone.
Climate change is by definition change.
Really, in a wing of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, a small crowd of onlookers is watching a debate between a man and an employee. The tourist is wearing a floppy hat and red shirt, and he's leaning on a silver-tipped cane as he listens, waiting for a chance to respond.
No, overall, it's broken world records.
The Arctic ice cap has increased since 2010.
No, it is not.
Kat Pratt is a ranger and interpreter. She was delivering talking points on sea level rise when the man, who didn't want to give his name, challenged her. He thinks rising temperatures are cyclical, not caused by people, and the climate change scientists are paid off by environmental groups. It goes on like this for about 15 minutes, until they move on to something they both agree on. The glacier looks blue. Pratt seems pretty unfazed.
I get it about once a day, usually, and some of them get more confrontational, maybe some not maybe as educated as that last gentleman was. And there's a lot to learn.
She says it encourages her to do more research, and she learns how to talk to visitors from different backgrounds. Many have never seen a glacier before and haven't been confronted with the effects of climate change, aside from, say, experiencing a hot summer.
It became our central topic, really, just in the last few years.
John Neary is the director of the Glacier's Visitor Center, and he's not afraid to admit he's on a mission. He wants the more than 500,000 people who visit the glacier each year to know that it's rapidly retreating due to climate change. The 18 interpreters who work for him are prepared to talk about it. He says initially, not everyone was game.
There was resistance, and I think it's because people view it as a negative thing. And, people on vacation, they don't want to hear about negative things. They want to think about positive, really exciting, and watch the whales, see the eagles, that sort of thing. I get that. That's understandable.
But he says it's all connected. Compounds from glacial silt wash down and feed the plankton that whales and other species depend on. Salmon spawn in nearby waters. In the past 30 years, Neary's noticed an extreme visible difference in the glacier. He started at the Forest Service around that time. And at first, for him, Mendenhall wasn't a big deal.
It didn't seem very special to me, to be honest. It was just a glacier. You appreciate things as they become diminished in your life, right? I mean, you look at them differently when they are disappearing.
Now Neary uses that when talking to visitors. He tells them about the time he was out hiking on a steep trail beside the glacier, and his dog fell 90 feet onto the ice. Don't worry, the dog survived.
But the story comes back to me when I go back out there and realize that that spot, which I climbed, is now more than a half mile away, and there's no glacier. There's dense alder thicket there, so there's big changes.
And to address those changes, Neary wants to make changes to the visitor center, too. He wants the building to be LEED certified in the next few years. That means it'll be energy efficient and produce less greenhouse gas. This approach has captured the attention of other countries. 11 delegates from Norway are visiting in June. Neary says they're interested in seeing what the visitor center is doing and also sharing ideas. Chilean park officials are planning a trip in the fall. Neary wonders if parks around the world are trying to figure out what their role should be when it comes to climate change.
I think we are one in a million in the setting that we have, but I would like to think that the conversation is happening everywhere.
Hi there, how are you? Have you had a chance to shake hands with the Mendenhall Glacier yet?
Inside the visitor center, an interpreter lures a crowd over to touch a slick hunk of glacial ice. People stop to take selfies with it and snap pictures.
Would you like to see some photos of the glacier in the past?
The photos start in the 1950s and show the progression of how much the glacier has changed.
Can't replace it, right?
No, we can't.
So how do we stop it?
That is a great question. And there's a
Anna Ling, one of the people who watched the presentation, traveled a long way to be here.
We're from Glasgow, Scotland.
She says being on vacation, she had no idea she'd learned so much about climate change.
It's just a statement that's out there normally, and it doesn't really mean much to you until you see the physical evidence of it, especially seeing as we're able to touch the glacier there and know what we're losing.
Some scientists say the Mendenhall Glacier won't be visible from the visitor center by the end of this century. John Neary hopes tourists have that in mind when they return back home. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
An unusual bird was spotted in two separate southeast towns on the same day recently. The ibises were a rare treat that has left bird experts scratching their heads, wondering why these southern birds have landed in Alaska. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has more.
Words like flabbergasted and astonishing came up when birders described hearing about the ibis sightings last week. The large, long-legged wading birds are not native to Alaska. According to bird experts, its northernmost boundary is the southern Canadian border. There's never been a recorded sighting in Alaska before now. Andy Piston is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Ketchikan. And while his professional focus is fish, he's been studying birds in Southeast for two decades. He says if you saw an ibis, you'd know it.
You'd definitely notice it's distinctive. You know, it's a heron-sized bird, and it's got a big, long, down-curved bill. And in the right light, their plumage can look really glossy and kind of iridescent-looking.
And according to the Audubon Society, they sound a little something like this. Or like this. The first glimpses happened last Thursday, one in Haines and one in Kluak on Prince of Wales Island. Bird enthusiast Jason Collins snapped a photo and posted a description of the encounter online. He wrote that he saw it in the early evening feeding in a grassy mudflat. He said its body shape and long curved beak were dead giveaways that it was an ibis. After a little research, he deduced that it was a white-faced ibis. Colin's friend Amy Courtney runs Icy Strait birding tours out of Hoonah. She says when he sent her the photo of the bird, she knew what it was right away.
And it was definitely an ibis, and I was just really kind of flipping out inside. I didn't realize that it would be the first Alaska record, but I knew it was going to be really rare.
Biologist Piston says the overlapping sightings are indeed the first recorded in the state.
I guess the bottom line is trying to say what caused that is pretty difficult. People would want to say it's related to the warm winter and spring, but you know, it could be something unrelated down south that just caused more ibis to be in the Pacific Northwest and a couple to stray up here.
Haines bird expert Pam Randles said an ibis was also spotted on Friday and again on Sunday in Haines. She says she's been fielding calls from interested parties across the state that want to come to Haines to see it, but alas, it hasn't been spotted since Sunday. Randall says big changes have been happening in the bird community over the last 5 years or so, and vagrants and oddities are becoming more common. Longtime Juneau birder Gus Van Vliet agrees that perhaps something is afoot with the species, but he says it also might be that more people are paying attention to feathered friends around them.
Yeah, it's hard to know whether the pace has picked up over the last 5, 10, 15 years, or whether there's just more observers, more birders, more interested people, and just more coverage, you know, sort of like rod hours for fishing for salmon. You know, the more hours you spend, the higher the probability of catching something like that. And that might be the case for these vagrants as well.
Van Vliet said there are two main kinds of ibises in North America, the glossy ibis in the east and the white-faced ibis in the west.
And it could be just a one-off event, and never to be duplicated for the next century, or it could be shades of things to come.
According to the Audubon Field Guide, they breed mostly in California, Nevada, and southern Oregon, and dabble in the Midwest. It says they are, quote, climate endangered, and that their northernmost range is indeed along the Canadian border. There have been recorded sightings in British Columbia, though not many. One account posted recently on the Haines Birders Facebook page says a group of three ibises was seen at Picture Point also last week. But whether these birds will stick around or even be seen again is anybody's guess. In Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
After 26 years, it's the end of an era for Unalaska's preschool. KUCB's Zoe Sobel visited class.
Teacher Susan Carlisle is retiring.
I'm going to be 73 this summer. It's time to quit. My energy at the end of the day is like, oh, okay, I'm tired. So, but it is hard to leave. It's hard to leave the island. I've lived here 38 years. So I'm going to miss it a lot.
Carlisle first came to the island when her husband got a job as office manager for Universal Seafood. Back then, she says, everyone at the company lived on a ship except for management, and there wasn't even a bridge in town. They were supposed to be here for a year, but she says she fell in love with the island. She left Unalaska to raise her daughter, and when she returned, she had no plans on teaching. But she spoke with a former school secretary who called the superintendent about openings.
I said, well, you know, preschool would be really fun. And when she talked to him, he said, right now, the only thing I know I have open is preschool. So I came back 26 years ago and started teaching and found what I love to do.
She'd previously taught first grade in Washington, but at 40, she found the best job ever. In Carlisle's classroom, most of the day is spent playing.
We develop fine motor by squeezing stuff, play in the sand, pouring. You know, it strengthens all these muscles, makes them move. So when you have to hold that pencil and you have to sit there and color, that you've got some strength in those fingers to do it.
Over the years, she says several people from the state have visited and said this is what preschool should be.
Whether you know how to read right now when you're 3 or 4 shouldn't be the most important thing in your life. It's like, you know, can you hold a pencil yet? Do you like to sit and color, maybe? Know how to cut? Can you open and close those scissors?
And she adds, play has a lot of benefits that some people do not see.
But if they don't have that strength when they have to sit and try to do that stuff, it's really hard for them. And they'll go, ah, I can't do that.
In Alaska, kids have to come to school by age 7. But kindergarten and preschool are not required. Carlisle stresses that those 2 years are an important part of development.
These kids here that are, you know, come in at 3, we're getting that brain going and working all parts of that brain. And it'll help eventually down the line.
Over her tenure, she says the percentage of children attending Unalaska's preschool has increased. Now she estimates it's over 90%. And after 26 years, she's never been bored.
I always look forward to coming to school, because it's never the same. Kids are different. Kids that day are different, you know, and I can hardly wait. Hey, we're going to do this today. It's going to be really fun.
But retirement has been calling her for a while. Her daughter and 6 grandkids in Oregon have been asking her to move for about 4 years. Plus, Carlisle's doctor has been pushing her to leave so she can deal with some medical issues. And for about 7 years, Carlisle has been telling her doctor that she'll retire next year. But this time, when she was serious, the doctor didn't believe her.
I said, I'm normally resigning. She said, I don't believe it. Fax me the resignation letter when you do it.
Even though she's leaving, Carlisle thinks she'll keep working with kids. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Writer Sumner McLeish listened to our recent story on the difficulty, expense, and stress for rural residents trying to get rid of bedbugs. McLeish has lived in rural Alaska, but it wasn't until she got to Anchorage that she first encountered Simex lectularius.
My bed is an island. It's covered with books, notebooks, research pens, paintbrushes, and often my beloved granddaughter. Still, it is an island. No part of my sheets or other bedding touches the floor or a wall. My pillows, mattress, and box spring are each encased in somewhat squeaky bug-proof covers. And there is talcum powder that I've spread along the edges of the room. Bed bugs are somewhat intolerant of baby powder. I moved into this great apartment last fall and was immediately assaulted by bed bugs. A pest control company came. During the first of four weekly applications, I walked around with the bedbug guy, peppering him with questions as he sprayed some concoction onto the walls, baseboards, and into electrical outlets. I was enjoying his company until he said, "Yeah, the weight of this chemical will take down bedbugs, but I don't think it can take down a person." I fled to my computer to start researching. An EPA report was full of do not do this statements, such as do not spray in a school classroom when occupied. The Alaska Pesticide Control Program and research from Michigan State University were helpful, and eventually it all boiled down to this: prolonged stress, considerable financial investment, physical and psychological harm. Did I mention my 2 a.m. trip to the ER when I was covered with hundreds of red, itchy bites and my blood pressure had skyrocketed? When I finally saw an ER doctor, he said, "It's not a medical problem. You can go home." Everything in the apartment had to be put in big black trash bags and moved into the middle of the living room and sealed for at least 3 weeks. Boxes should be broken down and thrown away. Throw away as much of everything as you can. Just throw it out. Vacuum, vacuum, vacuum. Buy bed bug encasement protectors. Well over $200 to outfit my bed. Shower every night before bed, wash your bedding at least once a week, and dry on high, high heat for a long, long time. Do not use shared or public laundromats, as you and your bedding might spread the bed bugs. I declared my own war on this invasion of rapidly multiplying blood-seeking bugs, and I was ruthless and utterly fearless with my piles of research, talcum powder, and duct tape sitting on my island bed as I vacuumed, washed, scrubbed, showered, and bagged day after day and night after night. Medication helped. Also, chocolate.
Anchorage writer Sumner McLeish is the author of Seven Words for Wind, Essays and Field Notes from Alaska's Pribilof Islands. If you've got an issue that's bugging you, or you're just itching to tell us something, okay, I'll stop. Email us, news@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Jillian Rogers in Haines, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and commentary from Sumner McLeish in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.